a Nabisco Oreos box.
And if you look carefully, you'll see the OU. Start it up.
Start it up. So it does mean that everyone who's buying the Oreos is buying the OU because the Oreos because it has an OU. Far from it, probably. Sorry?
The Frosties.
Of course, today.
Buy the book of mine.
In our sample. My son's snack tomorrow, so.
Don't mess with Daniel's
snack. And of course, in our day and age, we have the reduced fat.
Okay. We have options here. Now they have the double Oreo, the single Oreo, the reduced fat Oreo. It's like you can't just buy Oreos. You've got to decide, make another choice. So, but the way, with the plethora of products and symbols, we do have unbelievable choices today. And it's getting hard almost to find non-kosher food in the supermarkets. By the way, also, there are Jewish hate groups who will tell you that it's a Jewish conspiracy or that the kosher industry is milking the food industry. And we'll talk about that as we try to start to understand what really goes into the kosher symbol and the kosher industry. If you look at the pie chart here, it's very interesting because the first thing about that accusation is that the kosher industry services only 27% of the people being serviced by the kosher industry is Jewish. Okay, actually it's
44%.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, 44%. But over half buy kosher for various of different reasons. Okay, the 27% believe kosher is better. Okay, and we'll have to see is it or is it not. 19% are Muslims. We talked last week about Muslims eating, having similar laws in terms of slaughtering animals, and then 10% are vegetarians or people who have lactose intolerance. So what's interesting is that the kosher market has become gone beyond the Jewish market. Okay? Now, so what is it, does it mean if a product has a kosher symbol on it? Why would it need a kosher symbol? So we're going to see that there are three categories of food. There's something which is overtly non-kosher, and we talked last week about what would make something overtly non-kosher? It comes from one of the species of animals which is not kosher, or it's from a kosher species, but it wasn't slaughtered in the proper way. So any of those meats or any byproducts from those meats that would make their way into something we eat would make it non-kosher. Okay? Now, the larger category are going to be things that maybe... And by the way, obviously, if you have a canned beans that is beans and pork, you know it's not kosher, okay? Even though there's beans in there, which are kosher, okay? But the largest category are going to be... and so it's either that there's a kosher non-kosher product which is in it, or we're going to have to see next week, we'll talk more at length about the mixture of milk and meat, okay? Or it's a... Yeah.
But what about context? I mean, you couldn't eat a, or could you eat a bean that had touched a piece of pork?
So we'll talk about that.
Okay. Sort of like
we'll talk about that in a second. So then we have the in-between case, okay, where you're not sure it is kosher and you're not sure it's not kosher. So I once went into the supermarket and I bought organic beans, okay, and I saw that it said it was kosher, but I didn't know who it was. Now, we're going to see that there are certain kosher symbols which are very well recognized, and others which are less well recognized. So, I did a little research. I actually learned to do this somewhat professionally. When I was an assistant rabbi in the synagogue in West Hampton Beach, there was a bakery in town, and I was involved koshering the bakery and supervising the kosher status of the bakery. So I learned how to research all of this. But you can do it yourself. You just look on the can, called up the company, and I asked, is it under kosher supervision? There was a K on it. Now, a K means someone is supervising, but you don't know who it is. So I called the company. They said, hold on. They put me through their customer relations. They said, yes, it's this rabbi who certifies it. Can I get his number? Here's his number. I call up the rabbi, and I say, you know, do you supervise this? Yes. I said, well, why isn't it under one of the major kosher brands? He said, well, actually, what happened is that this brand makes beans, and it also makes beans and pork. So he says, every week, they run through the beans and pork. When they're done running that through, I come into the factory, I supervise koshering the machinery, washing it through, putting boiling water, and then they run the straight beans, and then, you know, the week later, they go back to the beans and pork. Which shows an interesting thing, is that you could buy a canned beans in the supermarket, but do you know what was made on the machinery before you bought the canned beans? You don't. So there could be traces, secret ingredients, if you will, of things in there that you don't know. I'll give you another example. If you've been to England, they have this very interesting vegetable spread called Marmite. Anyone know Marmite? Marmite? Okay. Some people find it disgusting. It's very tart. I love it. So you put a little butter, then you put a little Marmite. So you go out and buy Marmite. Now in England it's interesting because they don't have those symbols on the products. To find out what's kosher there, the rabbinate in England produces a list. You get a hold of the list and Marmite is on there. It's kosher. Okay, great. Except for the 8-ounce jar. And I was like, give me a break. You know? It's like, so I later found out, why was the 8-ounce jar not kosher? Because all the other sizes they make in a certain factory, on certain lines, the 8-ounce jar they make in the same line that they bottle lard. So once again, do you know what was run through the processing system before they ran this product through? So there are many different... food production has become so complex. The kosher supervising agencies have engineers, okay? Industrial engineers who visit the plants, because if you've ever been to a food plant, there's like pipes going, you know, all across the ceiling, this way and that way and all over the place. And sometimes there'll be one pipe going this way, another going that way, and what happens is they intersect. So they intersect. When stuff is going this way, it falls to the sides onto the pipe going that way. And you're going to have traces in that. And now, let's talk about this idea of traces of food. So, even though you might not want to have traces of lard in your food, does it matter? Does it make a difference? And I use lard because I guess that's, you know, we talked last week about the pig being kind of the symbol of non-kosher. But there is a principle in kosher that if something is less, if a non-kosher product is less than 1/60th of the kosher product, it becomes nullified. It's diluted to the point of non-existence. Okay? So if you would have, you know, I don't know, you're making, you know, in this restaurant they're making a big pot of stew, and one of the workers comes over and he's eating his ham sandwich, which he shouldn't be doing in there anyway. The kosher supervisor should be telling them that they can't eat their food, their lunch in the facility. Let's say they are, and some of it falls in. If it is less than 1/60th, it becomes nullified. Now, there are certain qualifications for that. Yeah.
Is that recognized by OU?
Now, it's a little more complicated because if it happens that something falls in that's not kosher, then I evaluate, am I still allowed to eat it? Generally, the kosher supervising industries do not want to use that as a first standard. You see the difference? In other words, if you know beforehand that it's bottled on that line that bottled something non-kosher beforehand, then you say it has to be completely washed out.
If after the fact you find out that something non-kosher fell into your food, then you can say, is it less than 1/60th? So no, they don't rely upon that as a matter of policy. Okay?
But will they, if they found out after the fact that it was something got into it that was 1/60th non-kosher, will OU or...
No, they would probably tell them, take off the OU and put it on the general market. But if you had to, let's say someone was very poor, and they were, you know, cooking their chicken soup on Friday, and, you know, as I said, the non-Jewish neighbor walks in and drops something in there by accident, then do I have to throw it out, or when I won't be able to replace it, or can I eat it?
Could
you
add stuff to it to make it one, like if it's 1/30?
No, you cannot then. Very good question. No, that would be definitely using the principle in a way which you're not actively allowed to. It's only after the fact. Once it's fallen in, can I? How do I evaluate it?
A little bacon to make that.
I don't know. What seems puzzling about this, if you had a big, huge bat, someone drops a pig ear in there, and it's, you know, it's like 1/100th, so it certainly passes muster. But then you're eating this. Your portion of that too. You could have a whole.
Okay. Okay. So there are certain. There are other qualifications. Okay.
Let's go.
One is that the taste of it is not noticeable. Okay. It cannot change the taste. If the taste is noticeable, then it has to. And by the way, by butyric acid, can 1 teaspoon in 2,600 gallons can enhance the taste. Okay, I don't know what butyric acid is, but you probably want to eat it very diluted if you do. So something that has that potency, if it changes the taste, then it would not be diluted. Okay, even 1 teaspoon in 2,600 gallons. If it was added to give color, and we'll talk about food colorings in a second because there's tiny traces, but it changes the product. And if the piece is still noticeable. That as well. In other words, it has to break down and be diluted completely into the product. Okay? And the qualification there is, can it be removed by sifting it? If it can, then it wouldn't be nullified. I mean, maybe a more apt example is you're sitting on the airplane. The person sitting next to you have your kosher meal. The person sitting next to you has their non-kosher meal. And, you know, they're trying to pry off the lid, and they finally pry it off, and some of the juice from inside their meat meal splatters towards onto your meal. Right? And, you know, if you don't eat your meal, you're going to be very hungry for the next 10 hours on the flight. So that would be an example where if you knew that it was just a tiny drop, it would not nullify, and you could still eat the meal. Okay, there's a more tangible, real-life example. Okay. So there are many cases where these kind of ingredients aren't, it's not just that, you know, it happened to be in the food production line before they produced the thing that was kosher. Sometimes, many often, there'll be agents which are added in willingly or for a purpose. For example, in Europe, many of the breads are, when they're baked, they grease the pans before baking it. What will they grease it with? With lard. So you think, oh, walk into a bakery in Spain, I can buy freshly baked bread. What did they grease the pans with? By the way, in France, this is known in the Jewish community, the French, you know, are very serious about their bread. So the baguette, the standard baguette you buy in France, they use these special forms to bake them so that they don't have to put anything on the pans. And people know that certain boulangeries, that the baguette are kosher because they know that, you know, it's made in this very specific way with no grease. So, another example. And here's an interesting area where we understand that, you know, the Oreo cookie, we'll talk in a second, you know, what ingredients are used in the Oreo cookie and what ingredients are put into those ingredients. But some things have kosher supervision. Aluminum foil. You ever see that? Aluminum foil. Say, oh, you know, those rabbis, they're really, you know, raking it in. You know, they're putting certification on things which, you know, aluminum foil. What could be, why do you need it? So apparently, aluminum foil is made with these big rotors that crush the aluminum. And sure enough, they were greased with lard.
in order to keep it moving through and smooth. So that's why aluminum foil. Now you look at most brands of aluminum foil, they all have, you know, they're almost all kosher. I guess they don't use animal-based...
We don't need aluminum foil, but it's because if it touches the food...
Well, yeah, if it would be greased with that, and then you wrap your sandwich in it, whatever grease was on there would come off onto your food as well. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that's a very good question. Toothpaste and mouthwash, it does go into your mouth. There's another principle that if something is not fitting for a dog to eat, then it's not really in the realm of food. Okay? You know, even though toothpaste tastes good, I don't think too many people are going to be drinking it.
I don't know, dogs eat pretty good.
We swallow by accident.
Yeah.
What about women's makeup? I know that like certain types of like lipstick and stuff like that is like shark oil based.
So here again, there are different opinions about it. That certain things, if they're not food, some writers will say, well, it's not food, so it doesn't need supervision. Other people say, you know what? Even though that's true, we still want to be careful and not to ingest anything that's not kosher. So toothpaste and mouthwash as well. Technically, it wouldn't be in the category of food, so you don't have to supervise it. But we like to say, you know what, I'm going to be extra careful and do so. Okay, before we get to those specific product questions, I want to go through some of the concepts first so we can understand it. Was there... Excuse me? So before we get to... It's going to be in the same category as those other things. All right. So now, other exceptions of secret ingredients that would not necessarily be nullified in small amounts. Enzymes. Enzymes cause chemical reactions that changes the entire nature of the thing that is being transformed. What is the classic example of that? Cheese. Does anyone know how cheese is made? So cheese is a dairy product, and it's fermented with rennet. What is rennet? Rennet is the enzyme from the inside of the animal's stomach. Okay? So even though a tiny bit of enzyme is taken, once it's put into the cheese, it transforms the entire nature of the cheese to go from cream to cheese. And it's called a davar hamamid, something that stands up a product. In other words, it transforms it. If you flip to the bottom backside of the sheet, look at the underlined on the upper left, rennet of an animal slaughtered by an idol worshipper, a non-Jew, or that of a novella of a carcass, is prohibited for eating. In other words, we cannot use the rennet from a non-kosher animal, even though it's a tiny trace. Because why? It transforms the cheese from milk into cheese. So it has an impact which is beyond just a small product being put into it.
That same concept applies to yeast?
Yeah, it would if yeast was animal-based, but I don't think yeast is ever animal-based.
I know, but you culture it.
Right. So it would also, it's the same thing. It transforms the very nature of the dough, and so therefore it would also be questioned. So look below. This is from the Code of Jewish Law. It says, although the taste of the stomach meat is not detectable in the cheese is forbidden for eating because the meat of the carcass, i.e. the juices that exude from it, is the agent that curdles and thus produces the cheese. And there's an interesting, and on the bottom right, there's the Talmud, the commentary, and then the Code of Jewish Law. If you stand up, catalyze cheese with the lining of the maw of a kosher animal. Now, what's interesting is, we're going to see next week, we don't mix milk and meat. So the enzyme from the inside of the stomach is, it's interesting because it's actually not the stomach, it's from the inside of the, I guess, the uterus where the milk is being produced in the animal. Okay?
Milk's produced in the uterus?
Where's milk produced? In the stomach? I don't know where it's produced.
Mammary glands.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. Okay, for a little biology here.
great memory.
So, if the taste is given off into the cheese, it is forbidden. If not, it is permitted. However, if you produce it in the maw of a non-kosher animal, then it is forbidden even in the smallest amount. Okay? So here's an interesting product. It's dairy, but it's inside the animal. But from the non-kosher animal, because it transforms the cheese, even in the tiniest trace, it would not be allowed to use it. Interesting other note. Butter. You'll see a kosher certification on butter, right? You think, why would you want a kosher certification on butter? How's butter made? You know, it's the woman with the plaid dress and the hair curl like this going, you know, with the butter churn, right? That's how butter's made, right? Breakstone, they got all these women going like this with their butter churns. So, actually, when cheese is made, there's a byproduct, which is a white liquidy substance, which is thinner than milk. What's it called? I forget what it's called now. That is a byproduct of the cheese, is taken and is added to the milk when they make butter. In other words, they're using the byproduct of the cheese making process, putting it in with milk to make the butter. So the butter has the rennet, which originally was used for the cheese. The byproduct is now taken and put into butter, so you have that rennet from the non-kosher animal ultimately appearing in butter. This is how complex food production is and how different products will be used and shifted from one area of food production to another. Okay, we'll get to other examples of that. Other examples of enzymes.
But using that example of the cheese, why is cheese not inherently not kosher at all times, since you have a piece of essentially non-kosher meat? You have meat and milk.
So it's not really meat. It's an enzyme from the inside lining of the stomach. It's not actually taking off a part of the animal itself.
Okay, so it's not a piece of the animal, but it still has to be kosher.
It's within the animal, yeah.
You can get it without killing the animal. Is that
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, now. So there is cheese. There is cheese with... Folks, please. There is cheese with vegetable rennet. And if you go to to natural food stores, you'll see it'll say vegetarian rennet, which, you know, vegan, people who eat vegan will buy. But even then, in the Code of Jewish Law, it says one can only eat cheese that is made, that is supervised. Okay? So we don't accept that as enough of a supervision. Now, there are other enzymes that are used. Lipase is used in margarine. It creates a sensation of butterfat. It's used in microwave popcorn, chocolate, caramel, and dairy products. Okay? What does lipase make from? It's an enzyme made from the gland of the animal or from the tongue. Okay? Or the gullet of the lamb. So, we found microwave popcorn, chocolates, caramels, dairy products. You think, what's wrong with chocolate, right? Cocoa beans. They crush it, put a little sugar in there, you know, heat it up, put it in a form, send it out, wrap it up. Much more complex than that.
That'll be in all types of popcorn?
No, not necessarily.
But you can have kosher popcorn with that type of enzyme?
No, the kosher popcorn, we know, does not have that type of enzyme, right?
It's from a kosher animal.
Yeah. Pancreatin and trypsin are derived from animal pancreas used in baby, and it's used in baby formula. Okay? So these are some of the enzymes which are found in products. Emulsifiers, okay? Mono and diglycerides, polysorbates and glycerin. What are they made from? They're made from animal products. They make the food creamier, okay? Gelatins as well. For example, the Danone yogurt, went from having an OU to a K symbol. Why? Because the low-fat yogurt, they found that if they used gelatin, they could have... they went from going, in one of these small things, from 130 calories to 100 calories. In other words, they can cut down the milk fat by adding in gelatin, which gives it more consistency. Once again, gelatin is basically made from animal bones that are broken down. Now, there's actually a debate about how, when something keeps its original nature, the animal bones are broken down to such a degree, there are some rabbis who argue that it's no longer animal. It's an enzyme, it's a chemical which was broken down to its chemical components, reconstituted, and then put in food. So there will be discussions about whether it's an animal product or not. Generally today in the kosher supervision world, it's not accepted as kosher. Once again, if there's a doubt, why not hedge your bets? That's really the policy. Planters peanuts. The regular peanuts in those little bags will have kosher certification. The ones with salt often will not. Why? Because they use gelatin to get the salt to stick onto the peanuts. Okay? This is how complex food production is. Okay?
With regard to the yogurt, so you have the K saying that it's kosher and the OU that...
Okay, so...
recognize it.
So now... we'll get to this later, but once again, K just means some rabbi is supervising it. Do I know if that rabbi considers gelatin to be kosher or not kosher? I don't know. I have to research it. Okay? Like with that can of beans, when I called up, I found out he was a Lubavitch rabbi, I made him reliable, and, you know, he was supervising the turning over of the line. So it depends who it is. Okay. So let's get to non-enzymes. So there are lots of other things which are put into food. Vinegar, regular vinegar can have, is alcohol-based, and it can have wine-based alcohols that are used in the vinegar. I mean, we all know of wine vinegar, but even non-wine vinegar can have as its alcohol-based wine alcohols that originate from wine. And sometimes... here's another example. It'll just say natural and artificial flavors and colorings. Okay, what does that mean? So, carmine, which gives a bright red color to like the Manachino cherries. What's carmine? Carmine is actually made from pulverized beetle shells. Okay. Remember when the camp used... remember in camp, not the kosher beetles, not the kosher locusts. Remember in camp, folks. Remember in camp when you used to have bug juice? So we always thought it was called bug juice because the bugs would fly into it, right? Right, the Kool-Aid, the bug juice. So maybe this is why it was called bug juice. I don't know. Civet. Okay, civet is used is used in butter, caramel, grape and rum flavorings and beverages, desserts, and in chewing gum. Do you want me to read you what civet is? Okay. This is the Consumer's Dictionary of Food Additives by Ruth Winter. It's derived from the unctuous secretions from the receptacle between the anus and genitalia of the civet cat. Okay.
What is that?
Caramel, grape and rum flavorings and beverages, chewing gum.
How do you spell
chewing gum?
C-I-V-E-T.
C-I-V-E-T.
Yeah. And what happens is... what happens is, folks...
So let's take, you know...
I have that... actually, this article is very fascinating. It's called The Story of the Artificially Flavored Moon Cookie. So they take your hypothetical cheese-flavored, you know, artificially flavored, cheese-flavored moon cookie. This cookie will have within it 10 to 12 products. What happens when you start doing the research is you find out that each of those products has within them 10 to 12 sub-products. Okay? So, I...
know a rabbi who he used to travel to China. He'd go on these 5-week tours in China. He'd have 2 suitcases full of tuna fish because he's not going to find any kosher food out in the wilds of China. And he traveled to these factories because these enzymes are made in humongous quantities in these factories, you know, way out in the boondocks in China. And so this gets to, first of all, once again, the hidden ingredients which you don't know about. You can just say artificial flavors. What are the 10 ingredients that go into the artificial flavors? Sometimes we won't know. But it also helps us to understand what goes into the process of kosher supervision. The largest supervising agency is the OU, which is the Orthodox Union. If you look at the back of your sheet on the bottom, that's a circle with the U inside of it. The OU maintains a database with over 275,000 products produced in 6,000 plants located in 68 countries around the world. Okay? So you see what kind of support system and database is needed to keep track of the complexities of food production today. And that's why there are many different food certifying agencies, but we'll go through it. Some are reliable, some aren't really reliable. Why? Because if you don't have the proper database, you can try and certify something, but will you really be getting to the bottom of what's in them? So the history of these kosher supervision, I mentioned in 1911, Crisco cooking oil became kosher, and it was so important because what was the standard cooking oil up until that time?
Lard.
Yeah. In 1915, the New York State Legislature enacted the nation's first kosher food law. And Katie just told me that her great uncle, Moses Feuerstein, who just passed away, was very involved in the Jewish community in the United States, went from like the 30s to the 50s. He was very involved in helping pass these kosher certification laws. Because if you don't have the government's backing, and anyone can come up, put up a sign, say kosher, how do you know? Is there any standard at which it's being held to? In 1930, Maxwell House Coffee becomes kosher, and with a famous brilliant advertising campaign of the Maxwell House Haggadah. Right? But why do you have the Maxwell House Haggadah? Because it was their advertising arm of getting the word out that Maxwell House Coffee was under kosher supervision. Brilliant, right? 1937, here's a fascinating story. Coca-Cola becomes kosher. Now, from 1937 till about 1987, I think there were 2 rabbis who... One passed away, then the other one took over. In 1987, there was discussion of the... 87, late 80s, early 90s, of the OU taking over the kosher certification. Why did it become such a cause célèbre, such a controversy? Because Coke prides itself on the fact that the formula is secret. So how can a rabbi be koshering it if the formula is secret? So what probably happened is they probably told the rabbis the formula. But Koch would not publicly come out and say that they told anyone the secret, because so the whole aura is that the formula is secret. So eventually, I think, basically it was leaked into the Jewish community that the rabbis really did have the formula, but we can't really tell anyone we do. And as we know, Koch is not just kosher, it's also kosher for Passover, which is a very interesting transformation. On Passover, we don't eat grains or corn. So on Passover, the OUP, it'll have a little P next to it, with the yellow cap, Coke, interesting enough, has... Folks, please, I'm going to ask you to hold your conversation. I just can't talk over people's normal with each other. Thank you. It has sugar in it, cane sugar, rather than corn syrup, and it actually is the original formula, and I think it tastes much better. So you have some fascinating accommodations for kosher, even within Coca-Cola. In 1965, Hebrew National and Levi's rye bread hit the market. And why is this so interesting and important? Because it's the first mass marketing of Jewish kosher foods to non-kosher audiences. Okay? It wasn't just to get a niche. It was this perception that we answer to a higher order. That you buy kosher, you'll be getting something extra. Once again, we saw that, what was it? 27% of the kosher market buy kosher because they're feeling kosher is better. Now, last week we talked about some of the benefits of kosher slaughtering. So there is an idea of kosher meat having certain benefits that others wouldn't. Yeah.
Don't something have an issue with Hebrew National Hawks?
Okay. Now, the irony is, the irony is that Hebrew National meats are not the highest standard of kosher meats. And I actually do not eat Hebrew National meats. I wouldn't say that they're not kosher, but they're not the highest standard of kosher. They're not glot. There are other issues with it as well.
Well, what are the other issues?
I'm not going to get into right now. Come talk to me afterwards. Okay. So, 1994. Hershey's, Pennsylvania, goes completely kosher. 150 lines of products produced by Hershey's Kosher. Hershey's, and now anything coming out of Hershey's, interesting, it doesn't have a symbol on it, but if you know, you look at the back, if it's Hershey's, Pennsylvania, you know it's kosher. Which is an interesting thing, why it's that you have to look that it's Hershey's. Folks, please.
I was just asking the...
I'm sorry, I just can't talk over people's discussion. Thank you. So Hershey's. So interesting thing is that you might have the same product, but it might be produced in different factories. So for a while, the Kahlua coming out of California was kosher, but coming out of Mexico was not kosher. I was once at a rabbi's house, and there's a brand of salsa which is kosher, and I looked at the jar, and I'm looking. And I didn't want to embarrass him, but I knew he would have wanted to know. So I said, you know, excuse me, there's no kosher certification on this. And what happens is the chichi salsa, so usually it's produced in some plant on the East Coast, which is under kosher supervision, but they also have plants on the West Coast, which are not under kosher supervision. So what might happen is if they run that low on products from their East Coast plant, who knows what happened? They ship it from the other side of the country, from the other plant. So you can have the same product coming out of different factories. One might be kosher, one might possibly not be kosher. And of course, in 1997, Nabisco gets the OU for 82 products, including Oreos, and we know that the Messiah must be coming if Oreos become kosher. So as I was saying before, if something has a K on it, it means that there is a rabbi supervising it, but who is that rabbi? So, when I was at the bakery in West Hampton Beach, there were, you know, on the cakes, like the little flowers on cakes? So you think this guy is there with the big thing, you know, making the little flowers. Not. They come in boxes, already dried, pre-made, and they stick them on. Okay? So, there's the box, and it says, you know, kosher, kosher. So I call up the company. I say, well, say it's kosher, but whose supervision is under? Oh, it's under this such and such a rabbi, who actually is in Israel. So where is it made? It's made in the Philippines. So I call Israel. His wife is there. Well, he's not here now, but he's in Sweden, but here's his cell number. So I call the rabbi from Israel, who's now in Sweden, who tells me, yes, 3 years ago he was in the plant in the Philippines, and he checked it out, and everything seemed okay. But he said, I haven't been back to the plant since. So they faxed me this letter from him saying this product is kosher. I looked at the date. It was 3 years old. You do a little detective work, and sure enough, you find out that that was 3 years ago. What's been happening since then? We don't know. And actually, this was the problem with this bakery. When I took over the bakery, it wasn't not kosher. It was under a kosher supervision. I went into the back. We were talking, and I said, well, you know, when was the rabbi last here? They said, well, 4 months ago. And sure enough, there were food colorings that had no kosher supervision. Now we know what can be in food colorings. And I had to re-kosher everything. And this was under a rabbi who said he was supervising it. He hadn't been there in 4 months, and he was getting paid. You know, just like every area, there are people who do their job, and there are people who don't do their job. I mean, I can disseminate it because it's important to know, but this is, that was the tablet K, which doesn't really answer to a higher order. So, there are symbols which are reliable. I put here the 4 reliable symbols. The most widely disseminated are the OU, the OK, the star K, and the backwards, the Chaf, the backwards CK. But if something just has a K on it, you don't know who supervised it. You can do the research. Problem is, you might get the name of some rabbi and then like, well, who is he? So I actually know people in the kosher food industry. They usually know who the cast of characters are. So I'll call them and ask them, well, do you know who so-and-so and so is? Yeah, Adam.
How often, so like, does somebody come in for the Oreo? With the OU, is there
okay, so this is a very interesting question. What level of supervision is required? Meat products require constant supervision. In other words, there has to be a supervisor there the whole time. Why? Because the differential between kosher meat and non-kosher meat is quite significant, and there's nothing distinguishing it, so they can just flip the meat. And by the way, there used to be, this goes years back, there was a kosher Chinese restaurant on 72nd Street. My friend who works for the OU told me the story. He said, he told me when I started to supervise the bakery, he said, a kosher supervisor has to be a detective. So, he said there was this restaurant on 72nd Street, and what was happening was when the kosher supervisor was in the front of the store, they would bring the chickens in from the back, they'd hide them in the dropped ceiling, the non-kosher chickens. Yeah. Then when he walked to the back of the store, they'd bring them back down and bring them to the front and put them in the fridge. And how did he discover it? So you know that chickens have a marker on the wing, right? Kosher and non-kosher. So you know even the brand, like Purdue, they have the metal plumber that goes on the wing. So he was sifting through the garbage, the good detective. And he found the Purdue markers. Now, what blows me away is, you know, so, I don't know, kosher chicken is $3 a pound, a whole swell. Non-kosher is maybe $1.50 a pound. How many pounds goes through there a week? In other words, he jeopardized his whole business to save, I don't know how much money. You know, it's a relatively minor, you know, overhead, extra overhead, but this is what happened. So meat requires constant supervision. Dairy and the bakery I supervised was a dairy bakery. It's you have to come and go. What does that mean? It means you make surprise visits. Because in dairy, the price differential is not so great, so there's no incentive for him to switch things, but you still have to check. So I'd be in and out maybe twice a week, not telling him when I would come in, because then, you know, they can prepare for it. And so that's the criterion to answer your question. But one of the reasons that kosher restaurants are more expensive, one of the reasons kosher restaurants are more expensive is because they have to pay for a full-time supervisor to be there on the premises. Now, a lot of times the supervisor will help out and work there as well, but it's an extra price cost. And, you know, when we're talking about price costs of kosher food, I mentioned last week, there are laws of slaughtering. The meat has to be salted. Now we understand that it has to be supervised, and you have to know at all times who's seeing it, who's supervising it, who's checking that it wasn't switched. What was your other question?
You still didn't answer how often for the OU people do they come in for the Oreo?
For the Oreo? So the OU now has adopted an interesting policy. The reason that original can of organic beans was not supervised by the OU is because the rabbi upstate told me the OU will no longer give supervision in a factory if in the factory they're making non-kosher things. And as the whole factory has to be kosher products. And so they come in, I don't know, sometimes they'll come in maybe 4 times a year, 6 times a year. They're not there the whole time, but they set it up so that there is only kosher products in the factory. If they'd be doing different lines, then you'd need someone there much more often to make sure, once again, the lines aren't crossed or things aren't barred from one to the other. So it also depends how you set up the facility. So each case, each one is on a case-by-case basis. Yeah?
Is there typically a price differential between the U and K?
Okay, so this is interesting that, you know, I told you there's some Jewish hate websites that will tell you, no, that the Jews are gouging the food industry and they are, you know, you are paying for their kosher supervision.
That's right.
Okay? Now, first of all, Nabisco, I don't know how many, you know, millions of, hundreds of millions of dollars of business they drive a year, billions. The cost from the OU of the kosher supervision of their factories is probably in the tens of thousands of dollars. So it's totally insignificant in terms of the overall budget of the company. So it's certainly not driving up the price in any way. And even if it was, they're making a business decision in terms of drawing, once again, not just kosher product, kosher clientele, but a range of clientele. It's interesting. The Pepperidge Farm cookies. So whenever I used to travel out of New York, they weren't kosher anymore. I've kicked my habit. I'm repentant. I do no longer eat Pepperidge Farm cookies. They're good. They're too good. Then you buy the bag, right? And you invariably want, you know, there's only 8 cookies in the bag. But invariably, like, you wind up finishing the whole bag in one night. You know, it's like, it's there in the kitchen. So that's crunchy with the chocolate. Yeah. So you travel outside. Then I found out, it was interesting, Pepperidge Farm went national kosher. Their sales in the Midwest went up like, you know, 15%. There are no Jews in these areas. So once again, interesting that, you know, the kosher is better, driving of the market brought it up. Now that we've understood what the kosher process is, we can say that in a sense, kosher is better. Why? Because if you're buying kosher, there's a certain level of disclosure of the product that you know there will not be other animal-based products that are added in. So it's interesting. If someone just, I didn't read the whole email, but tonight emailed me. Well, it's horrible to have your BlackBerry. I was like, so he emailed me that he's asked me about putting kosher supervision on a vegan yogurt place. Frozen yogurt place. Okay? So I guess it's all soy-based and fruit-based. So what is the answer here? The answer is that even though they're vegan, they might be buying certain products that have certain enzymes, and to what? And I've talked with people who are vegan. They do not have the, even though they're so careful about not eating meat products, they don't have the awareness of understanding what goes into enzymes and glycerides and all of these products. So just because something's vegan will not necessarily make it kosher. Okay? So saying that these are the four main supervising agencies. Now today there's a plethora of, there's the America K, it looks like the United States of America, the map and a K within it. There's the Torah K, looks like a Torah with a K in it. There's dozens and dozens of symbols. I've given you one resource here online. KosherQuest.org. He has a comprehensive list of all the different kosher supervising organizations. For instance, there are some which are very well known. The Moon Half Moon K, which is looks like this, and then it has a K within it. It's all over the place, but it's not really reliable. It's on a lot of the natural health food products, but it's just not. And you understand what I mean now by not reliable. You know, how often are they checking? Are they really have the database to look into what all the products are? Another area. I don't know if you want to hear about this, but so alcohol. Okay, we've all heard of kosher wine, and you know, wine needs to be kosher. By the way, one of the reasons wine needs to be kosher is that when wine is made the wine is pressed, and then there are certain sedatives that are still in the wine. And they let the wine sit so the sedatives will drop to the bottom. They also use enzymes to help the sedatives settle. A lot of the European wines use animal-based enzymes to help the shards settle to the bottom of the wine. But other liqueurs and alcohols also need kosher supervision. Now, the good news is, most of your... this is actually for the class on how to eat kosher and non-kosher places. Mm-hmm. But just to give you a little preview, most of the major... most of the standard alcohols, vodka made from potatoes or grain, gin made from juniper beans, rum made from sugar, and scotch made from wheat, most of those basic brands that are non-flavored are kosher. Okay? But just be aware that there are listings of, here you go, kashrut.com will have a list of kosher liquors and liqueurs. So, in a sense, let me finish and then we'll ask questions. So in a sense, the 27% who are buying kosher because it's better, you can say that there's a standard where you have an awareness, you have at least a tracking of knowing what is going into your product that you're eating and what is not in the product that you're eating. At least you'll know that animal-based products are not in the product that you're eating. And finally, we mentioned this last week, that eating kosher is part and parcel of our Jewish consciousness and of living a Jewish life. And we're very fortunate in this modern-day America to have an extensive major infrastructure which in many cases does not cost us more. You were asking before about cost, because as I mentioned, it's a tiny fraction of the cost of the product. It does not cost us more. Kosher meat and kosher restaurants will cost significantly more for the reasons that I said before. But other than that, you know, it's just a matter of looking for the symbol. So it really, in modern day America, it's so easy to keep kosher, because more often than not, if you're going looking for the cookies, more of the cookies will have kosher supervision than will not have it. Certainly in the New York area. So we're blessed to live in a time where eating kosher is easy, and knowing what's in our food is something which now has become a lot easier as well. We can be proud that kosher serves 50% of the kosher market is eating it, because we're providing a service to other populations who also are concerned about what they eat. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Taking a look at medications, over-the-counter medications.
So medication is a whole other discussion. Medication, once again, is not considered food. So while if you have a choice between a capsule, by the way, capsules are made out of gelatin, or a tab, it's better to choose the tab. But if you can ask your doctor, can I open up the capsule and dilute it into some orange juice? But if you have the choice, it's better not to. But if you can't and you need the medicine, then by all means, you're allowed to take it, because, once again, it's not considered to be food. It's not eating.
Okay, so there is an insulin doesn't really have to do with any of the excipients that they may put in there.
Now, vitamins and food supplements become more complex, because is vitamin a food or is it a medicine? Which category is it? So generally, we say that if you can get kosher vitamins, it's better. So, what is it? Solgor? With the gold label is kosher, and they're found all over the place. If you can get kosher vitamins, it's better too. But as long as they're not flavored. Remember we said before that if a dog wouldn't eat it, then it's not considered food. But once it's flavored, it gets into a different category, and then it's more of a problem. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
This has to do with dairy. Are we going to cover dairy, or should I ask later?
You can ask.
Okay. Yeah. I'm probably the only person that's not sure about this, but are eggs dairy?
So eggs is a very interesting case, because eggs come out of an animal which ultimately next week we'll see. Chicken is considered to be meat.
Okay.
although biblically it's not meat, but rabbinically it's considered meat, and we don't mix it with dairy. So if anything, you know, eggs maybe should be considered meat. So they're actually, one of the issues of supervision is that when you open up an egg, you've got to make sure there's no blood spots in it. Now most eggs today do not have them because now they have a machine that when the eggs are being boxed, they go through this machine, there's a light that shines through it, and a computer sensor will sense if there's an egg spot blood spot in the egg. Someone just told me, though, they buy organic eggs, and they told me there's blood spots in like 30% of them. So the brown eggs tend to have more as well. So the issue is the blood, once it starts to conceive, then it becomes meat. Right? But other than that, it's not dairy and it's not meat. It's par.
So can I eat eggs with meat?
Yes. Or you can eat it. I don't know. I always make my omelets with cheese. I don't know about you.
Chicken sandwich with mayonnaise on it because mayonnaise is egg-based.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Now, what's interesting is in terms of dairy, and we'll talk more about dairy next week, in terms of dairy, when the Oreo has the OU with the D next to it. Okay, so that's why we mentioned before that there's a whole population of lactose intolerant who are buying kosher products. Why? Because they know if it just has an OU, they can be assured that there's absolutely no dairy in it. Okay? And if it doesn't have dairy, it'll say OUD. Yeah. Of course, it's pretty funny because the milk carton has OUD. It's dairy. Ice cream, OUD. Yeah.
With all the complexities within the way that the food distribution and the centers where they work, it seems that, like you're saying, there can be a fair amount of corruption within what rabbis certify what. Now, it's not more of a question, more of a comment, but is there anything done to kind of root out those bad rabbis?
So part of the reason of having a large kosher organization is that the rabbi is not paid by the organization, not by the store owner.
Okay.
You see the problem, the store owner hires his own rabbi to certify him, and you're being paid by the person who you're certifying,
it's
you got a problem. Houston, we have a problem.
It's not like the banks and the rating agencies.
The what?
It's not like the banks and the rating agencies.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. So that's, you know, that's why you have these larger organizations, because if it's through the organization, and the larger it is, they lose one account, so what?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And you have to have a tough stomach. I mean, when I was supervising the bakery, you know, it's like,
right.
Oh, you get it, you buy this whole shipment of, you know, pickles, and I got them on discount, and there's no supervision. I was saying, sorry, you know, get them out of here. And they're not happy.
You're an example of somebody, though, who is, you know, very good, but I mean, not that most rabbis.
Okay, so the larger organizations have supervising rabbis who we know have integrity. They appoint, you know, their intermediary administrators who they know will keep their standard, and it's carried down through to the foot soldiers who are the people going out. In other words, they know that the people who they're choosing will be people of integrity. Does that guarantee?
No, of course
not. No, there was a controversy in Muncie, New York, where there was a butcher and he was switching the chickens.
Okay.
Guy was part of the community, very pious.
It was like 2 years ago.
People are human, you know. It's still not, right, you know, you can't guarantee.
You can't guarantee honesty, but
you work the best you can, yeah.
My question is, if they're not using all those byproducts that non-kosher food has, I mean, they use the products probably to make it taste better or whatever they're using it for. So what are they putting in kosher food to replace?
So they'll find, there is non-animal-based gelatin. There is kosher Jell-O. You know, maybe it doesn't wiggle quite as much, but it's got some wiggle. So there are substitutes. Rennet, they'll use, you know, vegetable rennet instead of animal-based rennet. So there are substitutes. Maybe they won't quite be as good. And that's, by the way, why Dannon's, low-fat yogurt went from the OU to the K. Because they found that probably the non-animal-based gelatin didn't give them the consistency they needed to bring down the calories, and they made a business decision. They said, okay, we're going to use it because
we don't have a viable substitute. You know, it's free market. Yeah. Alex and Mike.
So, taking a look at, like, the reform, conservative, and orthodox, you know, people that are reform or conservative that, you know, will want to be, you know, have kosher homes, they would be more inclined to identify themselves with K as the threshold and above, and then once you go...
Okay, look, different... Everyone's going to choose... Everyone's going to choose their kind of standard of what they are looking for. I'm here to give you information. Now you understand, K might be good, but you got to know who's doing it. So I'm just here to give information. Then it's up to each person to decide, okay, what level of, you know, awareness, kosherness, carefulness do I want to have?
So K is the minimum standard.
But there is another interesting point. The conservative movement has certain rabbinic supervisors and butchers. And there was a big controversy in Long Island because New York State law is if you say it's kosher, it has to be certified by a rabbi. Now, it had been under only Orthodox rabbis whose criterion were being accepted. And there was a big court case. And by the way, I think they were right. I think that, you know, conservative rabbis should have the right to supervise. You do your research, you know who is the rabbi. He's a conservative rabbi. If I'm comfortable with his standards, then I'll accept him. I know who he is, and I know what his, you know, what his standards are. So this has come up recently, and I think the law was changed. Now you'll have another phenomenon. You go to Katz's Deli, and what it'll say, kosher style. So some of them will have kosher meats. You go to Murray's on Broadway and 91st, they'll say kosher meats. So maybe the pastrami is a Hebrew national, but they'll serve it to you, pastrami with cheese, right? Then kosher style, some of them, it's not even kosher pastrami, just they're going to have, there'll be no pork, and there'll be pastrami, but it's not necessarily kosher pastrami. So, so there are different, once again, you've got to read carefully. And they will specifically say, they don't say that they are kosher, they say kosher meats sold. They don't say even kosher meats, they'll say kosher style. So you've got to read carefully what it says. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on chicken not being a meat? And is it alright to eat chicken with, say, cheese?
So, biblically, chicken is not a meat. It's not a warm-blooded mammal. But the rabbis put chicken into the category of meat, for the obvious reasons that it really does resemble meat. So, no, we cannot eat chicken with dairy. Okay. Yeah?
No, with par products, it's just automatically kosher and it's non-dairy? Is that
par means it doesn't have any meat and it doesn't have any dairy. So any regular OU product will be parv. Parv means parv. It means... Yeah. So it'll be, right, we'll have neither one or the other. Okay, folks, one more question, then we're...
Can you comment, I think a year ago or 2 years ago, the government locked down kosher butcher in
Pottsville, okay.
In the South, that they weren't really violating kosher standards, but they weren't treating the workers that good.
Yeah, this was a big controversy. It's very complex. It's in Pottsville, Iowa. Look, when it says kosher is better, it's better in the sense that you know that there are no animal derivative products in it. Doesn't mean it necessarily is the highest standard of cleanliness or of other ethical criterion. Not necessarily. You can go into a kosher restaurant that could be filthy and be infested and, you know, get a Department of Health citation. Still kosher, but there could be other problems. So, is it right? No. Does it happen? Yes. So you can have the same thing. This, by the way, was a big debate. I mentioned it last week. Can you say if veal is slaughtered with all the kosher laws, can veal be kosher if the animal is treated in such a cruel way? Right? Can food be kosher if the workers are mistreated? Technically, yes. And by the way, what the supervisory agency said is, our business is to make sure to know what is in the food. Okay? We are not in the labor relations business. The United States government is in the labor relations business to make sure that workers are not mistreated. And if they are, there are ways to complain. And sure enough, the place was raided and shut down. So then they said to rabbis, how could you give supervision to a place that was doing this or that to its workers? Now, what was going on or not going on, I don't know exactly, and maybe we'll only know once the court case finally is flushed out. But what the agencies are saying, we are responsible to know what's in the food. Other agencies are responsible for other dimensions of what's going on in a plant. We are not qualified to be judging what labor law is, whether it's being breached or not. Okay. All right, folks, have a good evening. Next week, we will talk about milk and meat. And the week after is how to make your kitchen kosher. And the fifth week will be eating kosher and non-kosher places. 6:45 next week is the basic Judaism class. Topic will be announced. And folks, give me one more minute, please. A week from Friday, we will be having our Friday night East Shabbat dinner here. On March 6th, call Shiri to register. Birthright. If you are under 27 or know someone who is, birthright registration is open till 9 a.m. Friday morning. So you can still sign up, or your friends who might be in that age categories can still sign up. We've gotten a very good response, but there are still some places open, so let people know. A regular MJ trip, if you don't happen to be in that age category, will be August 9th to 6th, 17th, the week of touring, fun, content, history, inspiration. Speak to Shira myself if you want to join us this summer to go to Israel. And our Purim party next Thursday, March 5th. Get your costumes ready, folks, and get ready for Purim. So that's it. Have a good night. There will be some kosher pizza back there. No pepperoni.
Birthright. Is that only for, do you have to be in New York, do you have to be in the U.S., or do you have to...
We're calling it a Manhattan-based trip, but if someone, if you know someone who particularly want to come on an MJ trip, they can sign up.
I was thinking of trying to get my brother to do it based in Singapore.
I don't know. I asked him today about foreigners who live in America. They can sign up, but Americans who live foreign, I can find out for you if you're really seriously
if you wouldn't mind.
Interested.
Definitely. Okay. I mean, I think about going.
Okay, email me tomorrow, okay? And we will ask.
Two things. Yeah. One, I can't believe it's not butter. That has to have a kosher symbol on it, of course.
Well, like I said, margarine has all these emulsifiers in it to give it that nice, creamy, smooth taste.
It's the same thing with the veggie cheese, too, obviously, like you said before.
Yeah.
Do they have a listing of all the kosher restaurants in the city? Is there, like, a Zenit?
Oh, yeah. That when we talk about eating kosher and non-kosher places, it's ckj.org.
Okay.
Very
actually the government what they